This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook Live today at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Happy Inauguration Day, Colin.
I'm not going to say good morning. I'm just going to breathe in a very disturbing manner.
We'll get to that in just a moment. Bill Curry is also with us. He's our Democratic political analyst. He's a former Democratic nominee for governor and advisor in the Clinton White House. Hello there once again, Bill.
Lovely to be with you, sir.
And Kevin Rennie is here. He's an attorney. He's a Hartford Current columnist, and he blogs at dailyructions.com. Hello there, Kevin.
Good morning.
As I mentioned, today is Inauguration Day, and that will be the bulk of our program today as Ned Lamont is sworn in to be the 89th governor of the state of Connecticut. But before we get to that, let's dispense with what we heard last night from Washington. President Trump used the Oval Office speech for the very first time to say that there is a crisis at the southern border, and he's trying to prompt action amongst Democrats, trying to build up support both from his base and perhaps from others for funding for a border wall. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
The southern border is a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs, including meth, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl. Every week, 300 of our citizens are killed by heroin alone, 90% of which floods across from our southern border. More Americans will die from drugs this year than were killed in the entire Vietnam War.
So that was the tone of much of what Trump said last night. We'll get to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's response in just a minute, Colin. I was listening to The Daily, the New York Times podcast this morning, and Michael Barbaro started by saying, I guess I'm wondering what we needed a primetime address for if we were going to hear the same thing from both Trump and really Democratic leaders that we've been hearing on Twitter and in every other form of media for the last several weeks.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common reaction. He certainly didn't say anything that he hasn't said in the past. He's obviously trying to set the stage for any number of moves he might want to make, either try to give some ammunition or at least aid and comfort to Republicans in Congress whose votes he wants, or maybe somewhere down the road to set the stage for a declaration of emergency, although I didn't really hear that in the speech last night. One thing about Trump is that he's not particularly good in this environment. He's good in front of a crowd with 4,000 people screaming their heads off. He's not really good in a quiet room with a teleprompter. He just doesn't really perform particularly well that way. And then it's exacerbated, of course, by this problem he has that makes it sound like he should be fitted for a black helmet or something. You know, I mean, he really has this sort of odd breath pattern where he, you know, sniffs pretty deeply at the end of every sentence. And that becomes kind of a distraction after a while. I mean, I hate to focus on superficial stuff. But I mean, I think there were sort of problems with the optics on optics, or I guess in his case, audibles on both sides. I mean, we can get to Pelosi and Schumer in just a second. But yeah, I don't think anything happened last night that really warranted, you know, preempting New Amsterdam or whatever show didn't get to go on the air.
Some commentators, certainly Bill this morning, have been saying he downplayed the notion that the wall is the most important thing, talking about the steel barrier that, as he said, Democrats would approve of, talking an awful lot more about border security writ large, not necessarily the wall, which clearly has not, let's say, tested well with the American public over the course of the last couple of weeks. But then, as in that soundbite that we heard, he peppered in an awful lot of statistics he uses to make a point, statistics which are often untrue or statistics that are wildly out of context. For instance, yes, a lot of drugs come across our southern border. Most of them do not come across unguarded portions of the desert. They come through legal ports of entry, et cetera, et cetera. So do you think we heard anything new out of President Trump last night?
Yeah, no, I do not. I thought, you know, a little piece of insider stuff I recall from my days with Clinton, and that is that when a president wants airtime, prime time, you actually have to present the speech to the networks to convince them that it's actually worthy of prime time. And I wonder what he showed them. I wonder if this was the first president who didn't have to show them the speech and just got the time. But did he show them this? And then they said, oh, sure, this is a big deal. Go ahead. We'll never know how this affected them because I'll bet he never tries to. I'll bet this was his last Oval Office address. I think it went that badly for him. My major takeaway from it is that I was reminded that for almost 3 years, Trump has run this truly wag the dog strategy. The fact of the matter is that every president since George Herbert Walker Bush has increased border security substantially and done everything they could. And by the way, it worked. Since 2000, there's been an 80% reduction in the number of illegal border crossings by our best factors, by the best data that we have. Healthcare hasn't gotten 80% better. Climate change didn't get 80% better. No real crisis got 80% better in that time. More people crossed that border going south than north over the last 10 years, which means a wall would just lock him in up here. I just think that what happened last night, he looked himself bewildered. It was supposed to be an executive order to build a wall or a threat to do an order. And in fact, he didn't even mention the wall itself. So I thought it was kind of a waving of the white flag and, worse for him, an exposure of his weakness and of the fundamental weakness of his argument. And our job is to go back now and say, how do we spend 3 years being hypnotized into thinking that a crisis that doesn't exist does?
Kevin, your reaction?
Well, I don't object to that they gave him 9 minutes. It's better than a press conference and less frightening.
I think we
don't want to get into let's hope this president is an outlier. We don't want to get into the business of denying the president a few minutes to deliver a speech. He should be careful about Vietnam references, though. I think someone might have slipped that in just to wink at us. And also, you know, I think that my understanding is that a lot of fentanyl comes from China.
It does.
That it's not really coming from our southern border. And really, as Bill said, we've made tremendous progress in the number of reducing the number of people who come over the border illegally. And of course, one big reason for that is NAFTA, which he rails against. In other words, that when NAFTA was enacted, Mexico's economy was the size of Pennsylvania's. And NAFTA has worked. And one reason we want it to work is that we want our neighbors to have thriving, free economies. And that's worked in Mexico.
What was your response, your thought about Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer afterward? Because, again, if Donald Trump was saying maybe less effectively than in his other formats, some things that he's been saying for a while, Chuck and Nancy said the same things they've been basically saying in the format they used last night.
They looked like Oliver and Lisa Douglas on Green Acres when the camera came in on them. And I thought, I don't think this is—
A millennial-friendly reference. Yeah. Thank you for that, by the way. Yes.
I don't feel so
current now.
But yes.
I don't think that I don't think it was a good idea to have them both standing there together. That's so unusual in our politics. That for a lot of the time, each one had to be quiet, and they were just looking at the camera, and it made for a very static presentation.
I just want to play a little clip from Jim Himes. He's a 4th District Congressman here in Connecticut. He was on Morning Edition this morning reacting. And the reason I want to play this is because I want to listen to a little bit of what he has to say about how Democrats in Congress might be approaching any upcoming negotiations with the president. Because what we heard last night from Chuck and Nancy, maybe a little different than what we're hearing from Jim Himes this morning.
When you really think about what he talked about last night, it feels like substantively we're pretty close. What is more challenging, of course, is that Donald Trump is not going to stand down from this shutdown until he can plausibly declare victory. So my guess is that there's going to be some way to find some number of miles along the border where you can take a wire fence and turn it into, again, to use the president's phrase, steel slats, to give him a way to save face out of this thing, and so that we can reopen the government, move on, and hopefully commit to ourselves that a government shutdown should never be in any legislator's legislative bag of tricks.
I may have been listening slightly differently, Colin, but what Jim Himes told us this morning doesn't really sound like the way Democratic leadership is approaching their negotiation, their standoff over the wall, over the government shutdown with Trump at all.
No, although there's what people say in public and what they say behind closed doors, the kind of compromise that he's describing doesn't seem particularly likely or very effective. I just want to go back to a couple of things about response. I thought the most important response last night that I saw wasn't from Pelosi and Schumer, although we can come to that, but it was from Fox News. Now, Fox News, when they're being a news network, when they have Shepard Smith up there and everything, they're not, you know, quite as ideological as they are if they're doing Hannity or something like that. But, I mean, Fox News fact-checked him immediately just the way everybody else did, said all of the things that have been said on this show today, that outgoing migration across the border exceeds incoming, that drugs are not coming illegally across the border. They're coming into legal ports of call.
Immigrants create less crime. Yeah. The non-immigrants.
They did all that stuff. Yeah. And if I were Trump, that would alarm me more than anything else because he doesn't have that many friends in the media. He doesn't have that many friends, period, at this point. So to have that happen, I think, was a problem. Just to what Kevin said, I totally agree with the optics of that. It was just kind of a terrible set of optics. And really, this is a situation where you either want to pick somebody who's a really good speaker, probably from the middle of the country. You had two coastal people there, somebody from the middle of the country, somebody who can really talk about this stuff. And, you know, one of the best turns of phrase that's been used about this so far is from Vicente Gonzalez, who represents the area around McAllen, Texas, where Trump is going on Thursday. And he calls the wall a fourth century solution to a 21st century problem. That kind of thing. I mean, one interesting thing is of the entire stretch of border that would be covered by that wall is represented by people who oppose it. I don't think there's a member. There's, I think, 8 members of Congress who are Democrats who oppose it, and one Republican, Will Hurd, who ran against the wall and won his election. So that's another thing they could have done is collected a few of the people who actually represent the areas along the border who are all opposed to the war. While that might have been a more effective way of coming back against what President Trump was saying.
Yeah, we heard from a governor's group last night on All Things Considered, Bill, Democratic governor from Montana, standing up and saying, we need the government to start working again. As Collins just said, there are an awful lot of people along the border who could have delivered that message. Was this the time to have Pelosi and Schumer deliver the message that they delivered?
I don't think either one of them is our best spokesperson. I think Nancy Pelosi is our best institutional technician, not our best spokesperson. She told people she wouldn't do much of this. I think she had little choice last night. I didn't think of Green Acres. I thought more of The Sopranos watching Schumer. He looked like he was her bodyguard. You know, might be packing heat. My great disagreement with her, though, was that the first thing Nancy Pelosi said was, we're going to begin with the facts. And then there weren't any. The only facts were that Trump's a jerk and the Democrats are working hard. And there were so many conflations. There were so many easy rebuttals. You know, you want to talk about the opioid addiction. Build a wall around Purdue Pharma. You know, it's not coming. It's not coming across that wall. The terrorists are coming from Canada. You know, the Canadians come here. They're all smiles. But it turns out there's as much trouble on that border. And so every piece of this is so easy to deconstruct. The facts are so overwhelmingly on the anti-Trump side of the argument. The Democrats, my biggest takeaway was that with a target this easy, the Democrats have to be better at marshaling facts and logic to make public policy arguments.
A last quick thought from you, Kevin. Did you want to jump in?
I was going to say it seems to me that they need to negotiate with Ann Coulter because she's the one who sort of frightened Donald Trump into reversing his stand on the initial budget agreement. Well, and he's, as Colin said, you know, they're going to have to come up. He's going to have to come up with some symbolism. It's going to have to satisfy her and Rush Limbaugh.
Satisfy her, Rush Limbaugh, and the base that they represent. But the other piece of this, the reason Trump may have seemed weak last night, the reason that Pelosi and Schumer may feel as though they hold all the cards right now is because the government is shut down. I mean, and there's real pain coming, right? The federal workers are going to stop getting paid this week. There's an awful lot of services not getting done, TSA not getting checked, farmers not getting loans. I mean, all sorts of stuff that is actually going to directly affect the economy, which could be the one thing that Donald Trump, as I heard last night a lot of people say, could get up and give a primetime speech, say, hey, you know what? The economy is actually doing pretty well, all things considered. But that's one thing that might be hurt by this government shutdown.
Yes, but I think he doesn't know much about the mechanics of government. I just think, you know, presidents, I imagine that most presidents who have some curiosity about what they're doing, they learn a lot while in office. And I don't think he's learned very much about how the government works.
Did you have a quick thought, Bill, and we got to go?
Just that while the speech was a big nothing, I think yesterday was a big turning point. I think I think Trump waved the white flag on the wall to a large degree. I think he looked bad to his own base. The reviews will get worse with each day. And Manafort and Bob Mueller says Paul Manafort was actually colluding and that he has the facts. That ended up being the second story. But as the days go by, that was the big takeaway.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to turn to, I guess, a cheerier subject. There's going to be a new governor as of today. We've got a bunch of coverage throughout the course of the day on WNPR. We're hearing from a Democratic analyst, Bill Curry, Republican analyst Kevin Rennie from DailyRuptions.com and the Hartford Current, and also our own Colin McEnroe. We'll be right back to talk more about Ned Lamont Day One here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. We're talking today with Kevin Rennie, who's an attorney. He's a Hartford Current columnist, and he blogs at DailyRuptions.com. Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, and also, of course, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. I love it when your shows kind of line up in some weird way with what we're talking about today. And your show today is?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it lines up with the speech last night more than it lines up with the inauguration. We're doing a show about Kafka today, and specifically the fight over his estate. But I also feel like, you know, people use Kafkaesque all the time without any particular understanding of who he was or what his work was. So we're going to do that. And then I should also mention, unless are you planning to mention Dankosky After Dark?
Well, why don't you mention it?
So at 7 o'clock tonight, Dankosky After Dark, we're going to, instead of rerunning this show, which would ordinarily go there at 7 o'clock, we're producing a special on the inauguration. We'll have Ned Lamont's speech, and we'll have commentary. We'll have state historian, hopefully Walt Woodward, talking to Patrick Scahill on the street about parades of the past, or I don't know. It'll be really fun, right?
It'll be fun. Actually, Dankosky After Dark, we're calling. Is that what it is? Yes.
I think Tori Amos is going to be here. I don't know.
Some slow jams for you this evening at 7 o'clock here in the space of the Wheelhouse. So we've got Inauguration Day today. Ned Lamont becomes the 89th governor of the state of Connecticut. There's a bunch that happens. It starts off at the state armory. A bunch of other former governors are expected to be there. There's all sorts of pomp and circumstance. Well, let's just start with the pomp and circumstance and the thing that happens today, Colin. Can you give us a little sketch about what normally we can expect out of Inauguration Day like today or that's maybe a little bit different or specific to this inauguration?
I don't know what will be specific to this inauguration. So there actually sort of are two major points of the inauguration. Around 12:30 today, the governor will be sworn in, following which that'll happen at the state armory with the other members, other statewide officers also present. At that point, he'll give a speech probably 5 to 8 minutes long. Sometimes that's the peppier of the two speeches. As I recall, back in 2010, when Dan Malloy was sworn in, that's when he gave the speech where he invoked Abraham Davenport and the great darkness in the state capitol and this, you know, kind of exciting story. So he gives a short speech, then there will be a parade. The parade concludes in the vicinity of the state capitol, at which point both houses of the legislature will convene. They, I believe, are being sworn in today at 10. That includes an awful lot of new legislators, an uncommonly high total of new legislators this year. They'll be sworn in. They'll convene around 2:30 or so, and he will then address both houses of the legislature. That address is expected to be between 15 and 18 minutes long. I did sort of talk to some Lamont people yesterday. I'm guessing that you're not going to hear this soar to exciting lyrical heights. You know, I mean, this tone that Lamont has struck so far, first of all, I don't think he's naturally a great orator. I don't know who's going to write the speech. But the tone that he's striking so far is get along with everybody. Don't blame anybody. Get along with everybody. Optimism. You know, we're going to move forward in the best way possible. We're going to fix as many things as we can. I think you'll hear a lot of that kind of stuff. I'd be surprised if there was some kind of Kennedy-esque moment of soaring eloquence, but I'd love to be surprised.
Bill, maybe no Kennedy-like eloquence. What do you expect from Ned Lamont today?
Well, the same thing. I mean, first of all, among Lamont's core strengths are basic decency and empathy, curiosity, and above all, I think optimism. And this state's been singing a funeral dirge for 8 years. Way out of proportion to its actual circumstances, in my own opinion. Our economy is ailing, but it's not dead. Our biggest problem is that our government's broken. So here's the ideal situation to be in. You're going to be running that part of it. And I think that just the very change from the very dark Daniel Malloy to the far sunnier Ned Lamont. I think of the last scene in Who Framed Roger Rabbit where the smiling sun and the cartoon bluebirds come out. The state could be walking into a much happier time. And the second thing is that there's a real opportunity here, one political. This is what, we're one of 14 states with a Democratic governor, a Senate, and House. We have this huge influx, as Colin said, of idealistic young members. And the very sense of crisis means the public has a real appetite for systemic change. The best news may be that we're dead flat broke. And the kinds of halfway measures that we've contented ourselves with for most of my adult lifetime in this state government, the string has finally run out. We literally can't do it anymore. So we should focus on a whole set of things. Lamont could open up the state employee health care contract to small business and self-employed, create the first public option in America. He could end all of our disastrous economic development programs and replace them with real support for small business. He could take a page from Pelosi's book and put an anti-corruption measures in. There are so many things that could be done that don't cost money and, in fact, save money. This is a chance. This is a great, great chance to lead, and I'm hopeful he's going to take advantage of it.
Kevin, how do you feel? Are you feeling bluebirds sunshine today?
I wouldn't
Kevin
say bluebirds.
Feels that.
I often do, but not yeah. not when I'm talking about Connecticut government.
Yeah.
I don't, you know,
no, it takes
my existence does not depend on the government. So my yep. state of mind doesn't depend on the government. Others are enthralled by government. I'm not so much, but. I do think today, you know, today's day to, I guess, expand a little bit on the themes that that he talked about a little bit during his campaign. There weren't many specifics in the campaign. There won't be a lot of them today, I think. But, you know, I think, first of all, it's a good day to remind ourselves of our wonderful tradition that has changed the world of the peaceful transfer of power. Mm. And we'll have a few rituals, and he will go home tonight to the governor's residence. The previous occupant has left, and it's all done in peace. And there was a time not all that long ago when that didn't happen in the world very often. And so we need to acknowledge that, and then he's got to get to work on the budget because it's a mess. You know, in November, Connecticut lost 500 jobs while the rest of the nation was generally expanding. And you don't solve a big budget deficit by losing jobs every month.
Well, one of the things that Bill said, though, is because we're in this crisis, because we're flat broke, that might focus the governor and this new government, which is more strongly Democratic, on fixing some of those problems. Another way to look at it is that they may come in with their new ideas and new things to do and new money to spend and new programs, et cetera.
I think that the ideas you've been hearing about so far from the from legislators, expanding gaming, mm-hmm. Legalizing marijuana, tolls, raising the minimum wage, and family medical leave, those aren't really budget issues. Those aren't spending issues. So they're going to be able to do those without having to give a nod to the deficit. But then they have to get to the deficit. And it's very hard to do other things until you address the budget deficits of the next 2 years and show how you're going to balance the budget.
Right. And so some of the push and pull starts today. For example, apparently during the parade from the state armory up towards the state capitol, there will be a group from Stanford lining the streets protesting tolls. So, I mean, they don't even wait, you know.
Well, that parade is such a dispiriting
right,
part of the inauguration. I think I would.
It's not a great parade.
Well, they may be the only ones. Yeah. Those people from Stanford may be the only ones.
It's a nice day. People are going to come out.
Are they going to erect a kind of a toll stanchion over the parade route?
Yes. Every float is going to be $35.
Oh, I like it. It's interesting. It's an interesting thought.
I will say, you know, back to this whole idea of kind of getting along and everything, one thing that will be interesting this year and kind of a little bit different, I mean, there often are former governors at the inauguration. Lamont did a very unusual thing. He invited all the former governors, including John Rowland, who demurred. But you will see President at the inauguration, we would expect, Jody Rowell, who actually I think, lives in Florida now. Yes. But she's going to JetBlue up here for that. And Lil Weicker and Dan Malloy will be there. And I think, once again,
I hope Nikki O'Neill is there.
She's invited. I was told that she probably wasn't going to come. But, yes, I said on the show a few weeks ago, I think she might have been the best first lady of my lifetime. I think that the iconography, this is a day of pageantry and iconography and probably not too much substance, as Kevin, I think, said in the speech.
I just want to point this out, is that there's something very normal about Ned Lamont. I know he was raised and has lived in conditions that for most of us are quite abnormal. But there is something normal about him.
Ish.
And that is he doesn't seem vengeful. He can take a punch. He's not so eager to send one flying back. And I think that's going to be helpful.
I think it will be helpful. I mean, as we heard, Colin in his exit interview with Dan Malloy, a lot of other folks in their exit interviews with Dan Malloy tried to get a little bit, Bill, at the tone that he struck and the interpersonal relationships he had with people. This is a really important part of the job. And I think beyond just who we might know Ned Lamont as someone who is certainly more jovial and a little bit more normal in that way, the incoming administration seems to be striking a tone of really wanting to hear from everyone, wanting to hear from residents, wanting to hear from Democrats and Republicans, wanting to work across party lines a little bit and just be a little bit more welcoming. I can't help but think that when we had a similar budget crisis when Dan Malloy took office, shared sacrifice was his rallying cry. And it was a sense that the government—
mortification of the flesh.
Well, it was going to impose a shared sacrifice on everyone, as opposed to, hey, let's all get together and try to fix this problem, which is, I think, what I'm hearing from the incoming administration.
Hey, diddly-ho.
Yeah. let me just say that it'd be great to back that up with some institutional reforms. Going back to Malloy's first budget— it was concocted in a secrecy befitting a papal election. And the fact that so much of our government's been moved behind closed doors, one of the things that Pelosi just did is announce that everything's going to try to go through the hearing process in the U.S. Congress. We'll see if that's true. I think Matt Ritter's got a lot of good ideas and a lot of good people that he's put into place here. But if we can really recommit ourselves to the principle of democracy— the fact of the matter is that what you do behind closed doors is almost never as smart as what you do out in the open. And so a lot of this is – they're just process issues, but that's what democracy is. It's a process, and you have to respect it. If we do respect it and have full-throated public debates about the stuff that matters the most, the problems we have won't scare us as much, and we'll know a lot more about them.
Yeah. I actually want to play a little a tape to get to this point of working across party lines, hearing all ideas. This past weekend, Ned Lamont and his Lieutenant Governor Susan Bicewitz sat down with her friend Dennis House on his WFSB program, Face the State. They were talking about accepting ideas from everyone, regardless of political party, looking to reduce divisiveness at the state capitol. Let's listen to a little bit.
Are you getting some good advice from Republicans? I know David Stemmerman has penned a couple columns.
Thad Gray was on our transition team along with other Republicans, David Salinas. We took good ideas from everywhere, across the nonprofit, the business community. We've had all kinds of people participate.
I don't care. Leave your labels at the door.
Yep.
Our policy committees have been great, public and private, Republican and Democrat. And that's my message to the legislature as well. I need this. We've got some wind to our back right now. I know it's a honeymoon period and everybody's feeling pretty good, but I need you to keep that spirit going. Get us through this budget cycle. Let us turn the corner.
And we want to change the culture in Hartford, because there was a lot of bickering in Hartford between the governor's office and the legislature, and we don't need that.
Okay, so there's a lot in that little clip there, Colin, that perhaps we could react to. It was, those 52 seconds were, let's say, cliche-ridden, but it gets a bit at some of the things that they're trying to get to. What did you hear?
Well, let me just say this. I mean, Ned Lamont is a pretty smart guy, and I think at some level he knows. I mean, he used the phrase honeymoon period. At some point he knows. You can't be Mr. Rogers forever. There will come a day, there will come many days when, in order to get what he wants, and what he thinks the state needs, he is going to have to break some arms, or somebody on his staff is going to have to break some arms. And it might come sooner than he thinks. I mean, I think it's admirable that he wants to set this tone, that he wants to hear from everybody, check your labels at the door and all this kind of stuff. But, I mean, to be honest with you, most people don't check their labels at the door. Themis Claridis is not going to stop being a member of the loyal opposition just because, you know, he thinks it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. So that's coming soon. I have to say, having watched that interview, a lot of governors start off their time, and presidents for that matter, start off their time thinking that they can be kind of an interesting partnership between them and their running mate. And obviously during the transition, all of the signage and stuff has sort of said Lamont Bisowitz transition team. I kind of wonder how long that can last too. For the most part, governors eventually decide that their running mate should go off and preside over the Senate and do whatever else, you know, that ultimately it's going to be a different group of people, the people that they, I mean, they've never chosen their running mate for that purpose. They choose their running mate usually to balance some political questions on the ticket or to pull somebody who might be a challenger out of the race or, you know, a million different reasons, but not because I want to be like co-governor with you. And watching the body language between Lamont and Bisowitz during that particular interview with Dennis House, I thought, I wonder how many other appearances like this that they will do together.
Did you feel the same body language problem, Kevin, in watching that?
Well, I noticed that Governor-elect Lamont did not turn to look at Susan Bisowitz when she was speaking. And I think we've all been on that set, and you can turn to look at the person.
I look at each other.
To your left.
Chairs
yes.
do swivel.
Yes. you can turn.
He did a few times.
Did he?
But, yeah. But he might also have been media coach, too. The media coaches tell you, sit there, hands folded, don't move around.
I say this just because I think it's a fact, is it's been a long, long time since Susan Bisowitz has been involved in the shaping of serious public policy. She, as Secretary of the State, you just don't do that. And then she's been out in the wilderness for 8 years trying to claw her way back in. And in her campaign for governor, when she did talk about serious public policy, she said things like, let's collect $3 billion a year in tolls for 20 years. So I think that she may not be as helpful as she may think she's going to be, because these are complicated issues and they're difficult. These are going to be very difficult issues. I'll be very surprised if she is on the tour nodding her head as he tries to explain how we bridge $4 billion in a budget or a deficit in the next 2 years.
Over the course of the last eight years, Nancy Wyman, the lieutenant governor, I think at the beginning, Dan Malloy involved her a little bit more. But what we would see is periodically he would make a speech in which he'd say, and I just want to turn my attention to the best lieutenant governor in all of America, Nancy Wyman, and everyone would go, yay. And then we'd see her and then she'd go away again. And I assume that that's a little bit what will happen moving forward.
I don't think we'll see Schumer and Pelosi doing another joint address, and I don't think we'll see Bisowitz and Lamont doing a lot of these. And, you know, sometimes Lamont can sound naive about this in the way that Obama did. And Obama was naive. When Obama talked about getting everybody to the table being bipartisan, he had to understand that the people he was talking about, McConnell, et cetera, they wanted him dead. They had no interest in having that kind of a discussion. And what the Democrats – there's an opportunity here because Ned really isn't Malloy. And if Themis and the other Republicans want to have a dialogue, they can. They could – but I think it's actually more up to them than him. I think the door really is open. The important thing – I think, in my opinion, the Republican Party has moved so far to the right and has become so entrenched in its own partisanship, and this Republican Party is so dysfunctional – but the Democratic Party has to get bipartisan with itself.
I just have to ask you, the Republican Party in Connecticut, the ones that are represented by Themis Claridis and Len Fasano at the state capitol, you believe they've moved that far to the right too?
I think they're that dysfunctional. I think that many members of their caucus are, far more than in previous decades, and so that there's a rigidity there and a difficulty there. But there's no question, I take your underlying point, that there's a big difference between legislative politics in Connecticut and congressional politics in Washington. But I'm not sure what the Republicans in Connecticut have to contribute at this moment.
Well,
there
okay,
are great,
you know,
divides in the Democratic Party that need to be broached, and he can start by doing those. Kevin,
yeah. We have a balanced budget this year. That was a bipartisan budget and driven largely by the Senate Republicans, particularly the Senate Republican budget person, Lisa Hammersley, who was the most skilled person in state government on the budget. And they let her – the Democrats let her get away. She should have been put into a high position in OPM. They meant this about a government of talented people no matter what their political party. And so this year's budget is balanced because it is a bipartisan budget. And they were able to do something quite unusual in Connecticut in the last several years, a balanced budget without a tax increase. And you mentioned Thad Gray who ran for treasurer.
We have the lieutenant governor.
Yeah, she was in the clip. Yeah,
and that's right. She met. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. And he was on the transition committee. They may have sort of dangled, given him the idea that they might want him in the government. So far, they haven't. So I'm not sure that beyond the transition committees, they mean what they've suggested.
I agree with what Kevin said, and especially about the budget. And I think there's sort of two models, the performance on the budget versus the sort of constant sniping that did go on over the last few years. And I think that there's a chance here to be bipartisan. But as at the federal level, so too at the state level, the big differences really right now in our national political debate are within the Democratic Party. If it can find a populism that doesn't pick your pocket and that is really problem-solving and pragmatic, they can go a long way here. They have to figure out their own differences first.
Colin, last thought?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this we just sort of have to wait and see how it really does unfold. I mean, all the talk that leads up to the ringing of the opening bell starts to vanish once things get started. It's hard to achieve comity over there. It's easy to achieve comedy over there. Comity is really hard. And, it's not even just interpartisan comity. It's hard to achieve. Many a session ends with the president pro tem of the Senate, a Democrat, hating the Speaker of the House, a Democrat, and the two chambers completely deadlocking each other over petty crap and important stuff doesn't get done. So Ned Lamont can't fix that. That's not even his job. But I'll be interested to see if the good feelings permeate those two chambers.
When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the other positions that Ned Lamont in the last couple of days has decided to fill, including a couple that are getting some bipartisan rounds of applause. An awful lot of lawmakers are going to be leaving their jobs to go work in the new Lamont administration. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, with Bill Curry, and with Kevin Rennie here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. I will just let you know that as a programming note, tonight's Wheelhouse will not be a rebroadcast of this program, but we will have not only Ned Lamont's speech that's happening at around 12:30 today, hopefully, but also his later speech, his State of the State address. So we'll be having those with some analysis and some of our reporters. That's coming up at 7 o'clock tonight on The Wheelhouse. I'll be joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show and my co-host here on The Wheelhouse. Kevin Rennie is also with us today. He's a Hartford Current columnist, and he blogs at dailyructions.com. Bill Curry is our Democratic political analyst. A lot of appointments within the last couple days, Colin, including a national search for a new DCF commissioner that ends right here in Connecticut. We can go through an awful lot of the other appointments, and maybe there's some that stand out to you. I'll just say the appointment of Vanessa Durantes to the DCF seems to have gotten an awful lot of support, including from people who've been very, very critical of the Department of Children and Families, and there has been a lot to be critical of in that department.
Right. There's always two ways to look at an appointment like this one. The negative way, less optimistic one, pessimistic way, would be to say you're appointing somebody from within a fantastically dysfunctional agency that has just for decades under different names been plagued with problems. I don't really like that interpretation. I'm inclined to think that the people who've been working there know what the problems on the ground are, have a better chance of fixing it, know the personalities that they're dealing with, know the realities. I'm hoping. It's an agency that really needs some good news. It hasn't had good news practically ever. So it would be really great if this turns out to be the right choice.
Bill, any other thoughts on some of the appointments? We see Jonathan Harris going into the administration, Beth Bye going into the administration, and not only Beth Bye, but other lawmakers, meaning there's going to be some special elections. Anything else stand out to you in terms of some of the talent that Ned Lamont is bringing in?
First of all, I agree with Colin that having that sense of what's been going on inside for a long time is helpful. The great malign neglect, however, of our entire social service bureaucracy has been on the part of the politicians at the very top. In the years in which I was seeking this job myself, I promised to move the governor's office into DCF for the first couple of months until I myself had figured out for sure what I thought the real problems were. And this is a test of our ability to focus that attention. So far, I like the kinds of people he's bringing in. I love Jonathan. I love Beth. It will set off a lot of interesting races. My friend Michael Daly is running in Farmington. Saad Anwar looks strong in the 5th District if he can break through that East Hartford delegation and get a nomination. It's amazing how many more legislators are going to be elected in the next few weeks. But overall, I think that just painting broad brush, a lot of new people coming in, the proof's in the pudding. But I think that Lamont's choices so far in personnel give us hope.
Kevin?
I think it looks like a good choice at DCF, but the other important thing to do there is to change the deputy commissioners and let some light into DCF. I do think that would solve a lot of its problems. They're nasty to the press. They're very secretive, and they could probably use a new spokesman.
There are an awful – I was going to say there's an awful lot of agencies that have some people who are coming back from the Malloy administration. As you suggest, Kevin, it's not always who's in charge of the department. It's often the people who are deputies who have been there for a very long time through many administrations. Do you sense that there is change coming to several of the agencies that maybe could use a fresh look?
I think so, but I don't have any evidence of that on the next tier. I want to say something about these putting the legislators into the administration.
Please.
First of all, they're not at critical jobs that they've chosen. Mm-hmm. And so today, about 10% of Connecticut citizens will not be fully represented in the legislature. And that will probably go on for a couple of months. The system to replace them is closed. There is no primary allowed. You reassemble the delegates from last summer who are generally friends and allies of the people who resigned. And this is a highly anti-democratic process that Ned Lamont has consented to and really created in his appointments. Those people, if they wanted to be in the administration, then don't run for a full term in last November. That was 2 months ago.
Do you think that there should be some prohibition against this?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I think, you know, make your decision the summer before. But, you know, all these people got public financing, which is hundreds of thousands of dollars in the special elections. They're going to get hundreds of thousands of dollars. They may open other seats up for special elections later in the spring. And it's a handful of people who decide who get these nominations. And the turnouts are very low in the special elections.
And I just want to underscore what Kevin said about the process itself. You have people, the delegates to the East Hartford, West Hartford State Senate conventions were chosen because they were strong supporters of the incumbents and because they'd heard there was food being served that night. And now they're being given a real choice. The very least they could do is elect new delegates. The idea that there's no primary, no new delegates, no democratic process. These state senate to the political leaders in those districts, let me just say emphatically, you only get 36 state senators. It matters who they are. As Kevin said, you put a couple of these people and they can make a really big difference. And so at least make this process as open and substantive as you can. It's important.
So just to do the numbers, there's 5 people coming out of the legislature into the Lamont administration right now. But as has been suggested, for example, in the case of Beth Bai, I think Derek Slapp is probably the front runner to succeed Beth Bai. That opens up his seat. So we're really not just talking about 5 special elections. We're talking about more. There's still a seat in the House that has not been decided yet from the November election. So that's another area of uncertainty. And I agree with what Kevin said. I think that's absolutely true. I was especially disturbed when Jillian Gilchrist, who had primaried against Andy Fleischman, won the primary, but before even being sworn in for one day as a newly minted state representative, floated the idea that maybe she would seek Beth Bai's seat. She pulled back from that eventually, but I'm thinking, wow, just get sworn in or something before you try to find another job.
Well, let me just give you an example, because I live in the 3rd Senatorial District. And
yes, you do.
There are some I say that not because I have any interest in running for that seat, but, you know, we have this issue of crumbling foundations, absolutely critical to many, many thousands of people who live in that district. We need a state senator in the opening days and weeks of the legislature because that issue, you know, that issue could be overlooked without a strong, without a voice there.
And as you were saying just a moment ago off air, Kevin, I mean, after the budget goes out, after this pomp and circumstance today, you know, the governor kind of goes away. The legislators at the Capitol are making an awful lot of the progress on things like that. They need to be there.
Yeah, they need you need to have someone there pushing that legislation in the Senate, particularly. And the other state senator from the most affected area is a freshman Republican, you know, who's going to learn how it works in the kind of grim way that a minority member does.
We have to take a break just because we're almost out of time. And I want to get to some thoughts that each of you have, either feats of strength that you've seen throughout the course of this last week, or maybe a grievance that you'd like to air. Kevin, where do you want to go this week? A grievance, a feat of strength?
I have a feat of strength.
Excellent.
You want to hear it?
Yeah, I do want to hear it.
All right. On Sunday, I attended the Boar's Head Festival at the Asylum Hill Congregational Church.
Yes.
And it is the 52nd annual presentation, and it is just magnificent. And it marks really the end of the Christmas season, but the Epiphany. And it does it in a way that acknowledges the, you know, the religious aspects of Christmas with beautiful soaring voices and a lot of razzle dazzle.
I love that. Right? Yeah. Soaring voices and razzle dazzle. That's a good feat of strength. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bill, quickly, what do you think?
So much earlier this morning, I was doing a quick interview on another radio show, and I looked out my window, and there were Farmington police and a German Shepherd on my property.
What have you done?
And that was my first thought, believe me. And just
I bought it
away.
In Northampton. It's
legal.
Yeah.
And they'd apparently been following someone who'd fled the scene of an accident, who'd come up to my house. The dog had chased him up there. And it just reminded me, one, I have a great hometown. I love Farmington. And the Farmington police make me safer and make me feel safe all the time. And I talked to them afterward. And just as so many years ago when they came and comforted me when they had the bear in the garage, each time they show up, I feel a little better. I want to thank them.
Oh, that's another good feat of strength.
They do good work.
I will say that I have a grievance this week, and my grievance comes from a Boston Globe article. We've talked an awful lot in the past, Colin, about the lack of transparency in government. Very quickly, as Boston and Massachusetts officials were trying to lure Amazon to that region, it turns out that the heads of both Boston University and the University of Massachusetts shepherded them around, and they signed a non-disclosure agreement with Amazon saying essentially, you can't talk about any of the things that we do here today. And it seems to me to be clearly undemocratic for the state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth there, to be paying people to run the state university. And then they sign a non-disclosure with a big company that is shepherding them around or the other way around to try to get Amazon to come there. A good on the Boston Globe for finding those emails. Colin?
I have a grievance.
You guys are so negative.
Remember in Bull Durham where Kevin Costner gets really mad at Tim Robbins for singing Try a Little Tenderness wrong? It's like She May Be Woolly or something like that. Yeah. It sort of bugs me, too, when people get lyrics wrong, particularly when they're citing them in a very important way. So, Ned, I love you for the fact that you went to see Hamilton and you got very excited about it. But there's something you've done in multiple interviews that's starting to bother me, and I think we can hear it right here.
Celebrate the fact that Susan and I went to see the musical Hamilton
with
about 2,500 high school kids. And my favorite song is I'm Not Gonna Waste My Shot. And that's what Alexander Hamilton felt. That's what these kids felt. And that's the message we're telling them. And I think that's what Susan and I feel. And that's what I'm gonna tell the young legislators as well. Don't waste your shot.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to say. However, that's not, in fact, how the lyric goes. And he keeps doing it. That wasn't just a slip of the tongue on Face the State. Every time he invokes this particular lyric, he makes this mistake. And I'm praying. I heard that there's going to be Hamilton in the speech today. I hope somebody has got him to get the quote right. Can I throw to the clip yet? Or are we
oh,
ready?
Please,
okay,
go for it. Yeah.
Let's go.
Don't be shocked when your history book mentions me. I will lay down my life if it sets us free. Eventually, you'll see my ascendancy. And I am not thrown away my shot. I am not thrown away my shot.
Such a great song, though. He's got the underlying point, right?
It is a fabulous song.
But it's like saying your favorite song from Oklahoma is Buggy with the Fringe on top.
Well, that's okay. What a beautiful evening. We have to thank our guest, Colin McEnroe, of course, always. We're going to be back on the air later on tonight listening to Ned Lamont's speech. Thank you so much to Bill Curry. Thank you so much to Kevin Rennie. And thank you to everyone who produces our program. Thanks to Scott Brady. Thanks to Katie Solarski. Thanks to Kion Wolf for finding the music. Thanks to Carlos Mejia for all of his digital help today. You're listening to The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankowski.